A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about car safety for children. Car seats were mandated here in Israel a while back. He and Hannah have a Cybex, and he wants to know what to look for when buying one for the first time. Also, what are the common failure modes in actually using them? This feels like one of those topics where everyone has an opinion, but very few people have actually read the manual.
The manual is where the whole thing lives or dies. I mean, I spent years as a pediatrician, and I can tell you, I never once had a parent walk into my office and say, "I think I installed the car seat wrong." But when you look at the data, the misuse rates are staggering. There was a study out of the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, that found something like 46% of car seats and booster seats are misused in ways that reduce their effectiveness. That's nearly half. And I'd bet the numbers in Israel are comparable, if not worse, given how late mandatory car seat laws arrived here.
46%. So basically, a coin flip whether the thing that's supposed to save your kid's life is installed correctly. That's horrifying.
It is, but it's also a fixable problem. And that's what I find genuinely interesting here. The gap between buying the right seat and using it correctly is where most of the risk lives. So let's start with the buying part, because that's what the first-time parent is facing. You walk into a store or you open a website. There are dozens of options, prices ranging from maybe 400 shekels to over 3,000. Where do you even begin?
And the Cybex that Daniel and Hannah have, those are on the premium end. But price and safety don't always map one-to-one. What actually matters?
All car seats sold in Israel legally have to pass the same certification standard, either the European ECE R29, which is also called iSize, or the older ECE R44. The iSize standard is newer, and it's better. It requires side impact testing, which the older standard didn't. It classifies seats by the child's height rather than weight, which turns out to be a much more reliable predictor of how the seat fits. And it mandates that the seat stays rear-facing until at least 15 months.
That's surprisingly specific. And I know the rear-facing thing is a big deal. There's a whole parent forum rabbit hole of people debating whether to turn their kid around at 2 or 3 or 4 years old.
The biomechanics here are really clear, actually. A child's head is disproportionately heavy, about 25% of their total body mass in infancy, compared to about 6% for an adult. Their cervical spine isn't fully ossified. In a frontal collision, which is the most common type, a forward-facing child's head gets thrown forward with enormous force. The spine can stretch up to 2 inches, but the spinal cord can only tolerate about a quarter inch of stretch before you're looking at internal decapitation or severe spinal injury. Rear-facing distributes that force across the entire back of the seat. It's not even close. Rear-facing is dramatically safer for as long as the child fits within the seat's limits.
There's a phrase I wish I didn't know now.
It's the thing nobody wants to talk about, but it's the whole reason these standards exist. And the iSize standard pushed the minimum rear-facing age to 15 months, but Sweden has been doing rear-facing until age 4 for decades. Their child traffic fatality rates are among the lowest in the world. In Sweden, forward-facing a 2-year-old is considered almost negligent. Here, you still see people flipping their kids around at 1 year because they think it's a milestone.
Rear-facing as long as possible. That's point one. What else should someone looking at a seat for the first time actually check?
Fit to the car and fit to the child. Those are the two things that matter more than brand, more than price, more than any marketing feature. A 2,000 shekel seat that doesn't fit your car's back seat properly is worse than an 800 shekel seat that does. You need to check whether the seat can be installed tightly in your vehicle. And different cars have different seat contours, different belt lengths, different anchor point positions. Some seats just don't play nicely with certain vehicles.
Which is ridiculous, by the way. The idea that you can buy a certified car seat and a certified car, and they might not work together. That's a systems integration failure, of the kind that would get an engineer fired in any other industry.
There's an ISO standard called ISOFIX that's supposed to solve this. It's a rigid attachment system that clicks into anchor points built into the car. No seatbelt routing, much less room for error. Most cars sold in Europe and Israel since around 2006 have ISOFIX anchors, but not all cars have them in all seating positions, and not all ISOFIX seats are created equal. Some have a load leg that extends to the floor. That's a telescoping support that prevents the seat from rotating downward in a crash. If your car has underfloor storage compartments, some load legs won't work. You have to check.
The checklist so far. iSize certification, rear facing as long as possible, fits your actual car. ISOFIX with a load leg if your car supports it. What about the child fit part?
The harness needs to be at or below the child's shoulders for rear facing, at or above for forward facing. The chest clip, if the seat has one, and many European seats don't, needs to be at armpit level, not down at the belly. The strap should pass the pinch test. You should not be able to pinch any slack in the webbing at the shoulder. And you shouldn't be able to fit more than one finger between the harness and the child's collarbone.
I've seen parents driving around with kids basically swimming in their harnesses, puffy winter coats on, straps twisted. It's like they think the seat is a suggestion.
The winter coat thing is a real hazard. A thick coat compresses in a crash. All that loft disappears instantly, and suddenly there's several inches of slack in the harness. The child can be ejected from the seat entirely. The fix is simple. Dress the child in thin layers, buckle them in, and then put the coat on backwards over the harness or use a blanket. But this is exactly the kind of thing that most new parents don't learn anywhere.
Which brings us to the failure modes. You've got the winter coat.
Loose installation is number one. The seat should not move more than 1 inch, about 2.5 centimeters, side to side or front to back at the belt path when you tug it. If it does, it's not tight enough. I've seen seats that could practically swivel. The fix is usually putting your knee in the seat and pulling the belt tight or using the ISOFIX tensioners properly, but people don't test this. They install it once and assume it's fine for the next 2 years.
The set it and forget it approach to child safety.
Which fails because seats shift. Kids kick them. You take the seat out to clean the car and reinstall it wrong. You move it to grandma's car and back. Every time it's reinstalled, you should check the tightness. Almost nobody does.
What about the straps themselves? Twisted straps. Is that actually a problem, or is that just aesthetic?
It's a real problem. A twisted strap concentrates crash forces onto a narrow line instead of distributing them across the full width of the webbing. It can also prevent the harness from tightening evenly. In a high-energy collision, a twisted strap can fail. The fix is tedious. You have to unthread and rethread the harness, but it matters.
I'm guessing forward-facing too early is another big one.
Parents get excited about seeing their child's face, or the child gets fussy rear-facing, or they just hit the legal minimum and think that means it's optimal. The legal minimum is the floor, not the ceiling. In Israel, the law requires rear-facing until age 1, which is actually less than the iSize standard's 15 months. But best practice is to max out the rear-facing limits of your specific seat, which for many convertible seats is 18 kilos or 105 centimeters, which often gets you to age 4 or beyond.
The legal minimum is floor, not ceiling. That should be on a poster in every baby store in the country.
It isn't, which is a public health failure, frankly. Israel's car seat law was only passed in the early 90s, and the specifics have been updated piecemeal. For years, taxi drivers were exempt. They still are, technically, though most parents don't realize that. If you get into a taxi with a child in Israel, the law doesn't require a car seat, which is insane.
The taxi exemption is one of those things that persists because nobody wants to be the politician who makes taxis less convenient for families. Meanwhile, physics doesn't care about political convenience.
Physics is remarkably indifferent to legislation. Another failure mode, using a second-hand seat without knowing its history. Car seats have expiration dates, typically 6 to 10 years from manufacture, depending on the manufacturer. The plastic degrades over time, especially in the Israeli sun. If a car has been parked outside through a few summers, the interior can hit 60-plus degrees Celsius regularly. That accelerates material fatigue. A seat that's been in even a minor crash should be replaced. Most manufacturers say any collision, period. Some allow continued use after a very low-speed parking lot bump, but you need to check the specific manufacturer's policy.
The expiration date thing surprises a lot of people, I think. It's not like milk. The seat looks fine, but brittle plastic in a high-stress situation is not where you want to discover the problem.
And the second-hand market is a minefield. People sell seats on Yod2 or Facebook groups, and they say, never been in an accident, but you have no way to verify that. A seat can look pristine and have microfractures from a previous impact. I would never buy a second-hand car seat unless it was from someone I knew and trusted absolutely. It's the one item where you really should buy new.
What about the transition stages? Infant carrier to convertible to booster. Are there failure modes in the transitions?
Moving to the next stage too early is the overarching one. Parents often think of it as a graduation. My child moved up to a booster. But each step up is actually a step down in protection. An infant carrier with a 5-point harness is more protective than a forward-facing convertible with a 5-point harness, which is more protective than a high-back booster using the car's seatbelt, which is more protective than a backless booster. Every transition trades safety for convenience or cost. Delay each one as long as you can.
The optimal parenting strategy from a safety perspective is to be inconvenient and expensive for as long as possible. Good summary of parenting generally, actually.
Parenting is basically a long exercise in trading your own convenience for your child's well-being, and car seats are one of the purest examples. But the booster stage has its own specific failure modes. The shoulder belt needs to cross the child's collarbone and sternum, not the neck, not the upper arm. The lap belt needs to sit across the upper thighs and hips, not the belly. If the belt is riding up onto the abdomen, in a crash it can cause seatbelt syndrome, spinal fractures, internal organ damage. A high-back booster positions the belt correctly. A backless booster relies on the vehicle's own seat geometry to do that, and it doesn't always work.
Another phrase for the collection. You've got a whole vocabulary of horrors today.
I've seen the aftermath of these things in the emergency department. I don't say any of this to be morbid. I say it because these are preventable. Every single one of these failure modes is something a parent can fix in 5 minutes in their driveway. That's what frustrates me about the gap between what we know and what gets communicated to parents.
Let's talk about that communication gap for a second. Where is a first-time parent actually supposed to learn this stuff? The hospital doesn't check your car seat before you take the baby home in Israel. The stores sell you the seat and hand you a manual the size of a phone book. There's no standardized education.
In some countries, there are certified child passenger safety technicians who will check your installation for free. The U.S. has a whole network of inspection stations. In the U.K., some retailers offer fitting demonstrations. In Israel, it's much more ad hoc. Some of the larger baby store chains will do a basic installation check if you ask, but there's no standardized certification for the person doing it. You might get someone who really knows what they're doing, or you might get a salesperson who watched a training video once.
You're basically on your own, unless you happen to know a pediatrician who's also a car seat obsessive.
Which, as it happens, Daniel does know one, but most people don't. And even the ones who do, I can explain the principles, but I can't physically install the seat in every patient's car. This is a systems problem. The car seat is a safety device that requires correct installation and correct use every single time, and we've designed a system where the end user is responsible for all of it with minimal training and minimal verification.
The car seat as the glockenspiel of automotive safety. Everyone agrees it's important. Nobody's quite sure how it works.
That's a perfect distillation. And it gets worse when you add multiple caregivers into the mix. Mom knows how to adjust the harness correctly. Dad does it a different way. Grandma uses the seat from 3 years ago that's been in the storage closet. The babysitter doesn't tighten the straps enough because she's in a hurry. Every handoff is a potential failure point.
If I'm a first-time buyer, hearing all this, what's my actual shopping list? Distill it for me.
Eye size certification, which is R129. Rear facing to at least 18 kilos or 105 centimeters, which means a convertible seat rather than an infant carrier alone. ISOFIX with a load leg, but verify your car, has ISOFIX anchors and a flat floor where the leg goes. Try the seat in your car before buying, if at all possible. Bring it out to the parking lot. Check that you can achieve a tight install with less than an inch of movement. Check that the harness adjusts smoothly and that you can reach the adjuster strap when the seat is rear-facing. And don't buy used unless it's from someone you'd trust with your child's life, because that's effectively what you're doing.
What about the Cybex that Daniel and Hannah already have? Where does that sit in the landscape?
Cybex is a German brand, very well regarded in safety testing. Their seats typically score highly in ADAC, which is the German automobile club that does the most rigorous independent crash testing in Europe. The Cybex Sirona line, for example, is one of the top performers year after year. They were early adopters of the load leg and the linear side impact protection. If you've already got a Cybex and it's installed correctly, you're in good shape. The question isn't really the seat, it's whether it's being used right.
The thing Daniel and Hannah own is good. The question is whether they and everyone else are using it properly.
That loops back to the failure modes. Let me run through a quick mental checklist that anyone can do in their own car right now. 1. Is the seat tight? Grab it at the belt path and try to move it. Any more than an inch of movement, reinstall. 2. Is the harness tight on the child? Do the pinch test at the shoulder. If you can pinch webbing, tighten it. 3. Is the chest clip at armpit level? 4. Is the child in the right direction, rear facing until the seat's limit? 5. No bulky clothing between the child and the harness. 6. Check the expiration date on the seat. It's usually on a sticker on the bottom or back. 7. If the seat has been in a crash, replace it. 8. If you're using a booster, check the belt fit. Shoulder on the collarbone, lap on the thighs.
That's an 8-point checklist that takes maybe 2 minutes. And yet, I'd guess most parents couldn't name more than 2 of those.
I'd guess most parents couldn't name one beyond make sure it's buckled. And that's not a criticism of parents, it's a criticism of the information ecosystem. We require a license to drive a car. We require no training at all to install and use the device that protects the most vulnerable passenger in that car.
That's the part that gets me. We've decided as a society that driving is a skill that requires certification, but keeping a child alive in a vehicle is something you're supposed to just figure out.
There's a book called The Myth of Instinctual Parenting. Well, that's not the actual title, but it's the thesis. We assume parents will just know how to do these things. But car seat installation is not instinctive. It's a technical skill. And the consequences of getting it wrong are catastrophic in ways that are entirely preventable.
What would a better system look like if you were designing this from scratch?
Mandatory installation checks before hospital discharge with a newborn, certified technicians at every inspection station in Israel that could be integrated into the existing annual vehicle inspection system. Better labeling on seats. The current labels are dense and technical. And honestly, car manufacturers and car seat manufacturers need to collaborate on standardization so that any eye-size seat fits properly in any eye-size compatible seating position. The fact that we still have compatibility issues in 2026 is absurd.
The perfect is the enemy of the installed. But in this case, the installed is also sometimes the problem.
That's the tension. You don't want to make parents feel like they're failing. The goal is to make it easier to succeed. Right now, the system is set up so that success requires above-average knowledge, above-average diligence, and above-average luck with vehicle compatibility. That's a terrible design for a safety system.
What about the specific Israeli context? Are there things here that are different from Europe or the US?
The car fleet is different. Israel has a lot of small cars. Toyota Yaris, Hyundai i20, Kia Picanto. Small back seats, short belt pads, sometimes awkward ISOFIX anchor placement. If you're buying a car seat for a small car, you need to be especially careful about fit. Some of the bulkier convertible seats simply don't work rear-facing in a subcompact because they require too much legroom behind the front seat.
Which is something nobody tells you at the store. You buy the premium seat, you get it home, and it doesn't fit in your Picanto.
And the Israeli climate is another factor. Those summer temperatures I mentioned, interior car temperatures can exceed 70 degrees Celsius in direct sun. That's brutal on plastics and fabrics. You should check the seat's materials periodically for signs of degradation, especially if you park outside. Fading is cosmetic, but brittleness or cracking is structural.
The driving culture here adds another layer. Let's be honest. Israeli drivers are aggressive. The roads are congested. The probability of a collision, even a minor one, is higher than in many European countries.
Israel's road fatality rate has been stubbornly high for years, though it's been improving. In 2023, there were around 340 road deaths, which for a country of under 10 million people is significant. The rate per capita is higher than most of Western Europe, so the statistical likelihood of needing that car seat to perform as designed is not trivial.
That's a sobering thought to park next to the 46% misuse rate. High probability of collision times high probability of incorrect installation. That's a risk equation that should keep more people up at night.
Yet the conversation in most parenting circles is about which stroller to buy, which crib, which brand of organic baby food. All of which matter, but none of which are the difference between life and death in a 30-mile-per-hour collision.
The car seat is the most boring, unglamorous piece of baby gear, and it's the only one that might save your child's life on any given Tuesday. There's something almost poetic about that.
The poetry of the unsexy safety device. Someone should write that book.
Chapter 1. The Load Leg and You.
Chapter 2. Why Your Mother-in-Law's Hand-Me-Down Seat is Trying to Kill Your Child.
You'd sell dozens of copies.
To bring this back to the practical, for someone buying their first car seat, the process should be research the seat's safety ratings, specifically ADAC or comparable independent testing. Check iSize certification. Verify fit in your specific car, ideally by testing it. Install it yourself. Don't delegate this, and read the manual while you're doing it. Then do the 8-point check I mentioned every single time the child gets in the seat.
Every single time?
Every single time. Because the one time you're in a hurry and you skip it is the one time it matters. I know that sounds like a cliche, but the statistics back it up. Most crashes happen close to home, on routine trips. The just this once mentality is the root cause of a disproportionate share of injuries.
The just this once mentality is the root cause of a lot of things. It's the universal human failure mode.
Car seats are uniquely unforgiving of it. Unlike a lot of parenting decisions where you can course correct over time, a car seat failure is binary. It works or it doesn't, and you only find out which one it was in the moment you needed it.
To summarize the buying advice, iSize, rear facing to the max, EasoFix with load leg where possible, test in your car, buy new, learn to install it properly. And the failure modes, loose installation, loose harness, bulky clothing, forward facing too early, twisted straps, expired or crash damaged seats, incorrect booster belt fit, and the cumulative effect of multiple caregivers all doing it differently.
The meta failure mode, assuming it's fine because nobody told you otherwise. The information gap is the real enemy here.
Which is a pretty good argument for making this kind of information more accessible. Not as a niche podcast topic, but as something every new parent encounters, as a matter of course.
There are organizations working on this. In Israel, Betram has done some work on child passenger safety awareness, though it's not their primary focus. Internationally, there's Safe Kids Worldwide, there's the European Child Safety Alliance. But the reach is limited. It tends to find the parents who are already looking for it. The parents who don't know, they don't know. Those are the ones who need it most.
The known unknowns versus the unknown unknowns applied to car seats. Donald Rumsfeld would be proud.
Rumsfeldian car seat epistemology. Now there's a niche.
We found our lane, and we're staying in it.
The point stands. If you're listening to this and you have a car seat, go do the 8-point check after the episode. It'll take 2 minutes, and it might be the most important thing you do today.
If you're buying for the first time, don't let the price tag be your only guide. The most expensive seat in the world won't protect your child if it's installed wrong, and a mid-range seat installed correctly will outperform a premium seat that's not. The installation is the safety feature.
The installation is the safety feature. I'm putting that on a bumper sticker.
A bumper sticker on a car with a correctly installed car seat.
Very on brand for this show, honestly.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the early Renaissance, artists in the Aleutian Islands used a vibrant red pigment derived from a lichen called Ochralechia tartarea, which produced a dye that was chemically distinct from the insect-based reds used in Europe at the same time. The lichen's color compounds, known as orchal dyes, shift from red to purple, depending on the pH of the processing solution. A property that Aleutian dyers exploited deliberately centuries before European chemists understood the underlying acid-base chemistry.
Right. Installation is the safety feature. That's where we'll leave it. If this episode saves one kid from being forward-faced too early with a twisted strap and a puffy coat, it was worth the hour. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this whole operation running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're feeling generous. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.